So a little bit of my story. So I grew up in Elgin, Illinois, which is right outside Chicago. It's a suburb. And then when I was about 5 years old, my parents got a divorce. My dad struggles with alcoholism and drug abuse and is in and out of homelessness. And so our relationship is challenging and always having to work at it. But I love him, right? He's my dad no matter what. And so learning to live into that relationship, that was really strained and difficult when I was five. At the same time, my mom also struggles with mental illness. And so, for many years, she was not, diagnosed. And so we didn't always know what was going on. And so my mom is finding a new normal for herself, in the midst of that. But when I was five, it was really challenging because there was neither parent that was really stable. So my grandma is really the one who sort of raised me. And when I was five, until I was about nine, she would take me to church every Sunday. And it was this like charismatic storefront church. And we would walk in and she'd be like, "Do you want to go to children's church?" And I'd be like, "No, I want to hear the preacher preach." And so I'd like grab her by the hand and like take her to the front row. And she would sit right, we would sit right in the front row. And I would just soak up like a sponge all the words the preacher had to say. And then I would go home and I'd grab her hand again. And I'd sit her down on the couch and I'd break down this little music stand. And I would just preach whatever like 5-year-old truths I'd taken from the sermon that day. And she would just listen. Usually it's probably all heresy, so I was like a heretic at five, apparently still. And so there was just like this moment, right, where my grandma would always be like, "Preach it, Jay, preach it." And I was found that like, yeah, I loved this and I was good at it. And my grandma, like, obviously it was like, I want to have a grandson as a preacher. And then when I turned nine, my mom got remarried and tried to create some more stability. And so she came back for me. And I stopped going to church during that time. My mom was not a churchgoer. And so I was a menace in elementary school. From like 9 to 12, I did awful things. I won't even like list them all here right now, but I'll tell you in the future. And the reality is when I was about 12 years old, the principal said to my mom, called her into the principal's office and was like, "Your son is a menace. We don't know what else to do with him. He's got one more shot, and he's going to a disciplinary school." And so my mom, obviously heartbroken and saddened by this, like didn't know what to do with me. So she dropped me off at an Assemblies of God church and was like, "Fix this kid." And I don't know how, but that took. In many ways, I would not say I am fixed, but I say that my time when I was in the Assemblies of God, it grounded me. It gave me a direction, and it gave me a new set of community that was a better influence for me, and it helped me channel like whatever acting out things I was doing in a way that seemed positive. And more than that, it was in that place that I understood the grace of God, that I could start over again, that I had made all these mistakes, and I felt it was this like kind of snowball effect, and I could never start over, and I was always making mistakes, and I didn't know how to be different. And there was this sense of grace, but also this sense of like, God, it could be with me and the Spirit could be in me and help me be the man that my mom wanted me to be and that I knew I wanted to be, but I didn't know how to be. And in some ways, they brought healing to me. In many ways, when I became a Christian at 12, for me, I began to realize that like God could be so many things to me that I didn't have. And it wasn't a complete substitute, and it wasn't exactly like a mother or a father. And it wasn't exactly like a role model that I could physically see all the time, but I saw something in Jesus that I knew I wanted to see in myself. And so early on in middle school then, I decided to start a ministry in my middle school because my friends were like, you know, "What happened to you? You like were crazy and rude and mean and awful, and now you have like crosses on your socks and you're carrying a huge Bible around." And so they called me Bible Humper for a little bit in middle school. And yeah, not Thumper, Humper, okay? Just clarity, not a mistake there. And at that point, I was like, well, I'm all in now. Like, I mean, I have nothing to lose. So I started that ministry. And by the time I was about 17 in high school, the ministry grew to well over 100 students, almost all who were unchurched. Only 3 of them went to church somewhere. It was a very eclectic group of people. You had like the emos and the punks and the jocks and the goths, and you had people who just like didn't fit anywhere, and you had people who were super nerdy, and it was like a really crazy group of people gathered together, all just kind of like trying to make sense of this Jesus person I was talking about that I was too trying to also make sense of. And by the time I was 17, this ministry grew pretty significantly to the point that the school like didn't want us to meet on campus anymore. So, Jay Sekulow, which is Donald Trump's lawyer now, he came in and actually fought for us a legal battle. Partnered with the LGBT group on campus, who was also being told they could not meet on campus because we were both non-curricular. And in the end, we won a legal battle, and we were able to, both groups were able to stay at the school. And as I stop for a moment and think about that time in my life, I think, like, that was crazy. You know, like we were like this seven, I was 17, and like they come in and they would sue this school, and they wrote about it in the paper, and like there's this moment where I look back at it and I'm sort of baffled by the ways in which I was not at that point affirming in any way or understanding of LGBT community, but like we partnered with them because we both had a common interest to want to be treated equally in the marketplace. And we both won that. And it was fascinating to think about how we partnered before I even thought about partnering or understanding that community at all. So from that place, there's a local Baptist church, American Baptist. They called me up one day and they said, "We read about you in the paper. We have this whole west wing of the building that's vacant that used to be a youth center. We'd love for you to come and have your meetings here. You can like use the whole wing." And so their youth started coming, and after a little while, they offered me a position as a youth director, which was crazy and bizarre, and there was lots of chaos in the church because it was a very stoic church with like presidents of universities, and they're like, "You're hiring a 17-year-old to be the youth director? Like, what is happening right now?" But they took the chance, and they did something crazy, and at the time, I didn't think it was crazy because I was 17. And so I just like went along for the ride. Now I look back, and I'm like, "Man, it might not have been the healthiest thing for a 17-year-old. But we did it nonetheless. And I did that, and then when I graduated from high school, they said, "We really want you to keep this job, so you need to get some letters behind your name and go to Moody Bible Institute." So I commute in to Moody and started there. And while I was at Moody, I met a professor named Dr. Christopher Yuan. And Dr. Yuan, his message is, and he travels to churches around the country, pretty much saying the response to homosexuality is singleness and celibacy. And I remember hearing this in the classroom for the first time and realizing, wow, this is me. Like, I'm dealing with same-sex attractions, and I don't know what to do with these attractions. And for the first time, someone in the church is telling me what to do with them, besides you're just going to go to hell for having them. And so I went, "Oh, so I'm supposed to be single and celibate. Okay, thanks for telling me what to do. Perfect, I'll do that thing." Not realizing quite all that that would entail and what that meant about how I would view myself, my own humanity, and how God made me, and if that was a mistake or where that was wrong. I just went, "Thanks for telling me what to do, now I'm going to do it." And so I came out to the pastor at the church I was serving as a youth director at, and he said, "This church just cannot hold that with you. They will not understand that, like, it's either straight or nothing." And he said, and I just said, "I can't live like that." And so I was let go from that job, which was very difficult. And then I quickly moved into another position. The church that I had grown up in, where I went when I was 12, the Assemblies of God, their pastor had resigned. And so I went and served as the interim for a while, and then they asked me to come on staff as the associate pastor, primarily doing preaching. And the other pastor was like the head of the school and did some administrative things. And for that first year, it was really great. And then the superintendent found out that I was gay and single and celibate. And in the Assemblies of God, you can be delivered of gay demons. And they believe that through reparative therapy, one can change one's sexuality, or at least fall in love with a person of the opposite sex, if not feel attracted to all. And so I was told to go through the process or resign. And because of my time at Moody, I knew that reparative therapy was not something that I believe worked. And so I chose not to engage in that, and I resigned. I spent the last 2 years at Moody trying to figure out, like, God, how am I going to be a pastor, love Jesus, and still be who I am fully in every way? And I wasn't sure how I was going to do it. And I was like, I don't need every church to accept me. I just need one. And I can't find that one. And so thankfully, though, after I graduated, I got a job the day after graduation. I moved to Madisonville, Kentucky, a town of 15,000 people, like an hour and a half from Nashville. And this church embraced me. I told them my story. I thought they understood. And within a few weeks, I realized that for them, being gay was something you do, not something you are. And I'd been celibate for 5 years and single for 5 years. And so for them, they're like, "Well, you used to do gay things. but you don't do those gay things anymore, so you're not gay anymore. Get what I'm saying? It's an action, not a part of who you are. So everyone's straight, but then sometimes straight people do a gay thing. So. Yeah. I don't believe that. But I did at the time a little bit. So I wrestled with that, and I went back in the closet then for those 2 years while I was pastoring that church, because I realized that they could not hold this with me and I was not going to lose another job. And I thought, I can just push this down, I can just forget about this. But I quickly began to realize, as I scrolled through Facebook, quiet nights alone at home where I was away 7 hours from family, didn't have any friends, and I began to scroll through Facebook and see friends get married and have kids. I began to see friends buy their first home. And I began to realize, wait, my same-sex attractions have nothing to do with just sex. I actually want to love another person of the same gender. And, like, I actually want to have a family. And I want to, like, do what Paul talks about, in that I want to put another person before me, and I want to experience what it's like to have someone else put me first and to love in this mutual way. Like, so this isn't just about sex, like I've been told my whole life. And so I began to really wrestle with that. And I studied in the scriptures, and I couldn't reconcile. I couldn't figure out how else to read these scriptures, how to make sense of it. And I filled with self-hatred, and I filled with self-loathing, and I filled with depression and sadness. And one night, I was sitting in my parsonage after having been at the church for a little over a year, and I began to plan my suicide. I thought, I'm going to go out into the garage. There's a couple holes. I need to plug those. I'm going to start the car. And I'll go to sleep. And hopefully, because the Bible doesn't say anything about suicide, I'll wake up in heaven. Before I did that, I kept scrolling. And I saw a friend post something about a gay-affirming church. And I was like, now, what is that? And so I'd never heard of it. And prior to this moment, if I had even scrolled through and seen that before, I probably wouldn't have clicked it, because I wouldn't have wanted to be sucked into a lie and that I shouldn't have ever believed. I should only read things that, like, I've been taught to believe, not anything that's different. And so I probably wouldn't have read it, but in this desperate moment, I was like, I just need something else. Because it seems that what I've been believing is bearing bad fruit. It's rotten, because I'm dying inside. And there's got to be better fruit. There's got to be a better tree to draw from for this theological belief on this. And so I clickbait, and I read it, and I went, wow, this is really powerful, but I need to read some academic work. Like, I need to read some work from, like, Harvard. I need to read some work from people who really, really I trust, and some theologians that I think know what they're talking about, and not people that are just, like, trying to twist this. So I studied for over a year deep theology, and I found myself very deconstructed, not sure what I believed about a lot of things. And then I went away to a thing called a walk for Emmaus, or a great banquet, one weekend. And it was in that place that in that silence. And I did not like silence, because in the silence, thoughts and feelings came that I didn't want to deal with. But I finally was faced with it during this retreat. And I just felt God say to me, Joshua, that's what God calls me by, Joshua. Don't call me that, though. Because that's what my mom calls me when she scolds me, right? Like, Joshua and God. So that's it. Joshua, you don't believe anything is wrong with you anymore. You believe that I have made you perfectly and wonderfully. And that there is nothing wrong with you having the desire to love another human being, just as I have loved the church and loved you. And this then meant I needed to resign from my church, because I knew they would not agree with that. So I drafted my resignation letter and I resigned from my church. And that's exactly what I thought it was at the time, my church. Because my whole life was wrapped up in it, my whole identity. Because I had nothing else to hold on to. Because I was so scared of myself. And so I resigned, and it was very hard, because I didn't know what I was going to do next. I didn't know where I was going to go. But I left, and I moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I worked at a high school for a year, and took a year to just, like, regroup and figure out what I was going to do. And within the first week there, I was like, I got to find a church. Like, I got to find somebody somewhere that maybe is, like, open to taking me and accepting me. at a place where I don't believe anything's wrong with me, and they're not going to tell me that anymore. At least when it, at least as it pertains to my sexuality, there's plenty of other things I got to deal with. And so, I drove past this church that said Messy Progressive Religion. It was United Methodist Church, and I thought, that's an interesting sign. I've never seen anything like that before. I'm just going to like walk in there and see what that even means. Like, I don't even know what all those words mean together at all. And so I walked in, and that's a place that embraced me. And I was there for a year, and they loved me like no one had ever loved me before. And I was able to fully integrate every part of myself. And I stood up in the pulpit for the first time, and I was able to say, I'm called to be a pastor, I love Jesus, and I'm super gay. Like, there really isn't a difference between like super gay, medium gay, or like low gay. It's just like, it felt like super gay was true for me because I really wanted to just be who I wanted to be and who I was and who God created me to be. So I just felt like I needed to superly embrace it. I'm not so much like that anymore since I feel like I'm at a place now where I can just, all things can be equal and not one is greater than the other. And so, in that time, I decided that in order to reconstruct some of my faith and my beliefs, that I should go back to school and get a master's. And so I'm wrapping up my master's now at Garrett Theological, where I've been for the last 3 years. And while I was there, I worked at an inclusive church called Urban Village that, again, is very similar to Imago, extremely similar to Imago. And they're a multi-site church in the city. And I was able to again, bring my full self there and find that I was also accepted as I accepted others. And then after serving there, I now serve as an associate pastor at Kingswood United Methodist Church, which is a church that is very diverse in theological as well as political thought. So you can have anywhere from a very conservative viewpoint to a very liberal viewpoint, which often means we avoid a lot of conversations. Because we don't want to cause tension, so we just talk about a few things over and over and over again. And that's okay for time, but I also think that there's time and space to, like, let's just dialogue about this. We don't have to agree about it. And so it's been an interesting space to be a part of and to learn and to grow. And that's where I'm at. And because I'm finishing now my degree, I have decided I'm looking for full-time work. And so I heard there was this place called Imago. And so now I'm glad to be in conversation and dialogue with you on it. So all of that before you, you could probably hear in my story that there are a lot of places where there's been hurt, right? There's been a lot of times when I could have felt like that person's now my enemy. There's been a lot of times when I felt like maybe I could have exchanged insult for insult or abuse for abuse, or I could have raised up and said, I want to get revenge or retaliate. There's been a lot of space and room for that. But I have learned quickly that that is not what God calls me to, and that's not helpful for me or for the person who I feel has wronged me or hurt me or thought different than me. This does not in any way build bridges or heal my heart to build up walls and to retaliate or to just ignore it and act like it doesn't exist. So today in our passage, I think what's beautiful about this passage here in 1 Peter, I said 2 Peter earlier, so forgive me for that, in 1 Peter chapter 3, is that Peter is giving this advice to the early church that they too are going through some tough stuff. So like, let's think about this for a moment. The church historically throughout most of the time either found themselves in these two different places. They were either in a position of power and privilege. You know, they had control. They got to decide what was orthodox. They got to decide what was mainline and mainstream. And oftentimes throughout church history, when the church had power and privilege, they used it to do some pretty oppressive things. Because they came from a pendulum over here where they were persecuted and powerless. And so when they got the power, they were like, we need to do everything we can to hold on to this, to make sure this does not escape us again. And so sometimes the very tools that were used to persecute and abuse and insult and oppress them, they end up using on other groups to hold the power. And I wonder at what moments they maybe would look at 1 Peter and draw back upon this and remember what Peter told them to do. Peter tells them time and time again, he says, sympathize with each other, be tender-hearted, keep a humble heart, don't repay evil for evil, don't retaliate with insults, don't push your beliefs on other people, as we were talking about earlier, right? Wait for them to come to you and ask you about it, and then with a gentle and kind heart, not abrasive and shovey, share the truth with them of what you believe. Share with them why you believe what you do and why you live the way you do. But I think oftentimes, just as we do now, as they have through all of church history, as they have through all of the texts of this beautiful book that we fall upon for our direction, we wean from the wisdom that is given to us by those who've learned lessons the hard way. Let's think about for a moment, like, the person who wrote this book, right? Peter, right? Can anyone tell me in the room? What did Peter do in Jesus' moment when he was getting arrested? What? He denies him, before he denies him, he cuts a guy's ear off. This is the same guy who says to not repay evil with evil and to turn away from evil and do good, right? Or also we could see, it says to not repay insult for insult. Like I said earlier, this could also be translated, don't return abuse for abuse. Don't return violence for violence. Like, it only escalates it. This is the guy who literally cuts someone's ear off when they come to arrest Jesus because he's going to fight back. And Jesus is like, what the heck, Peter? you've done some crazy stuff when we've been together, but you just cut a dude's ear off. But he's like, it's all right. We're going to make this right. It's going to be okay. This is not going to be like a mark against us. And so Jesus touches this servant who's come to arrest Jesus' ear, and the dude's ear grows back. Talk about God making things new and whole again and restoring the dumb choices we make. And Bet Peter's like, yikes, I really failed that one. Just cut that guy's ear off. I responded out of anger. I responded in the moment. I thought you wanted me to fight back. Jesus is perhaps reminding him as he falls upon the words of Jesus that Jesus says, those who live by the sword die by the sword. Those who retaliate with evil often just elevate evil and escalate it. There's a quote by Dr. Martin Luther King that I think is quite revealing that he seems to get what Peter's talking about here. He says, hate begets hate, violence begets violence, toughness begins a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man, but to win his friendship and understanding. It seems that Dr. King understood that in the midst of his people group being oppressed and discriminated against and looked over and treated differently, that he knew that he couldn't just sit back and be like, well, let's just play nice and be happy and smile until maybe they'll change their minds one day. Like, let's just turn the other cheek for a little bit. But he also knew that he couldn't pick up a sword and cut off an ear because that was only going to escalate the violence. So what did Dr. King do? Dr. King had to learn to petition and to protest and to love and to make his voice heard, not by ignoring it, but also not by fighting with the same tools and weapons that were used to oppress their people. And I think Peter here also realizes that is not what works, that Peter comes from this place that he knows through his own mistakes and his own decisions that is not what is going to take care of the situation. And so he writes to them from this place of understanding, this place of, I've been there, and you all, let me tell you, this is not the way to deal with this stuff. So you may be asking, well, then how do we deal with this stuff? Tell me what to do. What does this mean? Well, I think some of us had like really great answers earlier in the discussion. Quite frankly, you probably could have written a sermon yourself because in many ways, what you've said already is on the pages of this piece of paper that's before me now. So let's look at this really quick. In verse 8, Peter gives us some direction. He says, finally, all of you should be of one mind, sympathize with each other, love each other as brothers and sisters, be tender-hearted, and keep a humble heart. So here's an example of what I think that looks like. Just a few months ago, we remembered September 11th, right? September 11th, 2001, when the towers fell because of an act of terror from a foreign power. The country was tense, people were angry, people were confused, they began to demonize and paint all Muslims, or even, you could even say, just all people from the Middle East with one broad brush. And there was one church that was just a few blocks away, six blocks away from the World Trade Center. It was called the First United Methodist Church of St. Paul and St. Andrews. And that year they were preparing for their Thanksgiving gathering that they had every year. Everybody got together, classic potluck, they sit around, they talk. And they decided that this year, they needed to do something different for the Thanksgiving dinner. They could sense the hatred and the divide and the misunderstandings in the rooms and in the environment of the country. So they said, this year, we're going to do something else. We're going to try to find Muslims and Jews, and we're going to try to have a massive interfaith Thanksgiving meal together. And they only had a few months to do this. And they had to build relationships and trust quick, and it took a lot of time. But that year, for Thanksgiving, they had 50 Jews, 50 Muslims, and 50 Christians all huddled in a room. And there's a picture that'll go up here in just a moment that shows you just a glimpse of this moment of these people gathering together in a room who, quite frankly, everything in the world at that time had told them they shouldn't be together in a room, they should divide themselves off, they should be scared of one another and skeptical. And they gather into a room and they begin to share a meal. And the pastor of the Methodist Church says this story. He says, it was really, really bizarre, but also hilarious to stand in the room as they were trying to get, you know, a Jew and a Muslim and a Christian, sounds like a bad joke, at a table, at each table. And he said people would stand up and they'd be like, I need a Jew over here. I need a Muslim over here. I need a Christian at this table. And he's like, this is so crazy. But it's like, it was just healing wounds. And he said when they were done with their meal, each of their groups got up and read from their holy books verses about seeking for peace and working to maintain it. And they were able to talk with people at the table and realize that not all people were what they understood them to be in certain groups, and that they shouldn't just assume. And they had more in common than they had different. I believe this is what Peter's calling us to be a people that search for peace and work to be maintain it, a people who sympathize with each other, as he says in this passage, to be tender-hearted and humble, to not think that we're better than other people. We sang today loud, and I heard us, that when we see the face of our enemy, we see our brother, our sister. We have to work at that. We have to work at that, don't we? That's hard. I know when I pray, when I sang that, I was like, man, okay, I'm trying to picture who I feel my enemies are. And I was trying to picture them as I was singing that in my mind, asking God to help me to see them in that way, to see their humanity. How about this one? In verse 9, he says, don't repay evil for evil. I heard this story of this young boy. His name is Danny, and he goes to Williams Intermediate School, and he's in first grade. And all these kids in his first grade class would make fun of him because he wore suits all the time. Now, I'm going to tell you, he's a man after my own heart. Because I love to dress up. I was 5 years old. I was dressing up in everything I could. Oversized suits, suits that were too small, whatever I could get into. I just loved dressing up. Just always loved it. And so I remember sometimes being teased a little bit because I always wanted to look like wear those to school. My mom was like, are you sure about that? And I'm like, absolutely, I can handle it. And then I come home crying. And so he was teased for that, and then he was also teased for having a stutter. But he loved football, but he was too afraid to play football. So the fifth grade football team told him he could be their water boy. And he loved that, because he could stand on the sidelines and watch them, and he felt like he was a part of the team, and they did such a good job including him. But one day, some of the fifth graders in the team found out that he was being made fun of for wearing the suits and for his speech impediment. And so they decided this was unacceptable and they needed to do something to change it. And they decided that year that they were going to have a Danny Appreciation Day where the whole fifth grade class would wear a suit to school. And several of them escorted and hung out with Danny on the playground that day while some of the first graders made fun of him. And they were able to stand up for him and say, you know, it's really not cool to make fun of people for what they wear, for the way they talk. And they did this, they started to do this on a common basis to the point that all the bullying stopped for him. And then the school decided that they were going to do every year, they were going to implement the beginning of the year that the upperclassmen, the fifth and sixth graders, would get up and they would talk about why bullying isn't cool. And people would share about how bullying has hurt them and affect them. And because first graders look up to fifth and sixth graders for some reason, they listened. They listened. And it changed the culture of the school. Don't repay evil for evil. But Paul says, search for peace. Work to maintain it. You know, growing up, I got two things my different parents would tell me. When I would be made fun of, which wasn't a ton. I mean, I was kind of cool, just so you know, all right? But a little bit I got made fun of. But I had one parent that would say, listen, if they insult you, if they make fun of you, just come back with a greater one. And then I had another parent, my grandmother, who would say to me, Josh, just ignore them. They don't know what they're talking about. They're just insecure. And as I've gotten a little older, I've realized like neither of those are, like, I think, the response. If someone was being physically bullied or abused, you would step up and stop it. But if someone's being verbally abused, we often just say, I just ignore them. Abuse is abuse. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words, they do also hurt you. And so I don't think the response to evil and pain and suffering and these sort of acts that have been done against us is just to ignore it. And it's also not to retaliate with the same evil, but it's to do very similar to these stories that I've shared already. It's to figure out what's the systemic issue that lies at the base of this evil and how can we work to change that? How can we work to search for peace and work to maintain it? How can we change what lies at the base of this evil? How can I find out what's happening here? And like Dr. King, find a resolution that we continue to search for and work towards today. Last story I want to share with you is based off of what Peter says here. In verse 9, he continues, he says, don't retaliate with insult or abuse when people insult or abuse you. Instead, pay them back with a blessing. So as we bring a close to the message, I want us to think about this story that I think is a really beautiful image. Can you show the picture of the next one and the next one? There we are. So 1996 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that a bunch of 17 KKK members decided that they were going to get a petition, or I should say a permit, to protest outside of City Hall. And so they showed up. But before they showed up, word got out that they were coming. And so 300 counter-protesters showed up that day to counter-protest the 17 KKK members who were there. And as they were screaming insults about people of color, and they were screaming insults about immigrants and people who didn't fit into the mold of what they thought America should be and looked like, the counter-protesters, they met the screams and the yells with louder yells to try to drown out the sounds. After a little while, how many of you know that people begin to press in? A few shoulders butted, a few more anger and words rised. Before you knew it, a fight broke out. And this KKK member found himself on the ground, and many of the counter-protesters began to jab him with their sticks of their signs, and they began to spit at him and kick at him. And as the story goes, one person yelled out, kill him! Kill him! And with that, Kaisha hurls her body on top of the KKK member to protect him from the blows. And she says, there's got to be a better way. Stop. There is a better way. And as she uses her own body to protect a man who is there to protest that she shouldn't exist and was an equal, in hatred against her, she uses her body to protect him and to stop the violence. Because Kaisha got it. She knew that violence for violence wasn't going to work, and she knew that ignoring him wasn't going to work, but she knew that love would work. She knew. What I hear her saying as she lands on that man is, they know not what they do. He doesn't know the systemic and the cultural reasons that he has hatred in him for me. But this stoop to his level, that's not going to do it. I can't help but wonder what that KKK member had to think. I wonder how that changed him in any way. And I wonder if it did change him. I wonder if it stuck with him to think that the very person he was there to protest her existence, she defends him. She protects him from the violence. Peter in this passage is calling the early church who were in the midst of great persecution and they were hated, and many in their families turned their backs on them, because understand this reality is that the Jews during that time who were following Jesus, they were still considered a sect of Judaism because Christianity hadn't been formed yet. And so many of those who were converting to Christianity, many of those who Peter is writing to right here, They know what it feels like to have their family members and their loved ones and those whom they've worshiped with in synagogue turn their backs on them and say, you are one of those crazy, radical, inclusive Jews who are following Jesus and allowing Gentiles to come. And you have a generous orthodoxy because you're beginning to retranslate the Bible and the way that we've understood the laws and the prophets. And you think that Jesus is the Messiah. And they begin to have all awful things said about them because they weren't following Judaism the proper way. They were being hated and killed and persecuted. How many of you in this room right here right now know what that feels like a little bit? I know we're not a Pentecostal church, but I want to hear something.
Amen. Amen, brother.
There it is. Peter's writing to us. A people who are constantly opening ourselves to the Spirit and asking God, what is it afresh and new that you want to speak to us to show us? So the early church was going through. God, what are you speaking to us? What do you want to show us? And people didn't like him for it. And people said all awful things about them and insulted them and abused them and treated them awfully and acts of evil and even tried to kill them. And Peter's calling them the search for peace. The search for peace, church. We're called to search for peace and work to maintain it. Amen? Amen. And amen.